there was this great book, and we've actually interviewed the author. We're going to spend some time with the author of this book here in the first 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. The book called Shows About Nothing, written in the aftermath of the whole Seinfeld television phenomenon. Shows About Nothing. We're going to talk about objective truth and get a bit of a review of The Passion of the Christ from Dr. Thomas Hibbs. He's our first guest here on Issues, Etc. He's author of that book, Shows About Nothing, and he's the dean of the Honors College at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He joins us here in just a moment. Now, after that, we've got open lines. Simple Monday. Monday's a hard day for me because I stay up late on Sunday nights. Sunday nights are the nights we broadcast our nationally syndicated version of Issues, Etc. to about 100 stations nationwide. And that goes late. So Monday morning, I'm not in the mood to think or do anything. And actually, that feeling pretty much persists throughout Monday afternoon as well. So an open lines question for you starting at 3:30 here, starting in about 25 minutes. After we talk about The Passion of the Christ again with Thomas Hibbs, what do you think Mel Gibson's next movie should be? Coincidentally, last night, I think it was, I was perusing the cable channels. There was another Gibson film, his last big one, What Women Want. And I couldn't watch this film and watch Gibson on camera without the strange juxtaposition in my mind of the images of The Passion of the Christ to his latest venture in film. It was quite a juxtaposition. It was quite a jarring one at that. What do you think Gibson's next film should be? We'll take up that question with you during open lines in the next 25 minutes of the program. Then also we'll hear from the attorney for the two Unitarian Universalists ministers that are being charged with performing gay marriages in New York. And hopefully in the course of about 90 minutes of open lines, we'll also have an opportunity to get some conservative Methodist reaction to the exoneration of the openly lesbian and married in a gay marriage a couple weeks ago Methodist minister in Washington State. That took place this weekend. I'll also have a few things to say about that as well. In the last hour of the program, Professor John Pless joins us. He's assistant professor of pastoral ministry and missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We're going to get his review of Rick Warren's book, The Purpose-Driven Life. He says trying to use this book after you've taken out all the things that are unscriptural is a little bit like trying to drive your car after you've taken out the engine. We'll hear more of his thoughts on that in the last hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Thomas Hibbs is a regular guest here on Issues, Etc., dean of the Honors College at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Shows About Nothing. Dr. Hibbs, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
Let's talk about objective truth. You have written recently that that might be one of the most jarring things for the casual moviegoer when it comes to Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's striking to hear Gibson himself talk about the sort of biographical genesis of this in his own life. And I mean, he says that he's been thinking about making this film for 10 years, and that the spark for it arose from a kind of conversion in his own life, where by his own telling, for many years he had sort of lapsed from his faith, simply let it go, and had developed a fairly self-destructive, hedonistic lifestyle, and underwent a sort of conversion where he came back to the faith, and where he was then faced with the question, well, all this stuff that I believed as a kid is not what I thought it was for many years, merely a sort of likely story or a fantasy, that it's actually true. And he began to think about what that would mean to say that it's actually true. And that drove him to a consideration of the central claims of the gospel, Christ's claim to be Son of God, and his crucifixion for that claim, and the passion, crucifixion, death, and resurrection. So I think some of what is going on in this film, in the popular culture, and accounts for, I mean, there are a number of things going on with the film, but one of the things at the heart of the debate over this film is that it is a deeply countercultural film in the sense that it wants to present that audacious truth claim that is at the heart of the gospel, namely that Christ is the Son of God and that he is the way, the truth, and the life, and that he came in order to take up a cross for the sins of mankind and to be willing, out of love for the Father and love for mankind, to die and be raised up for us. I think that is really at the heart of the realism of the film as Gibson has developed it, and it is what is given rise, I think, in part to the criticism and certainly in large part to the attraction of the film to so many Americans.
The realism, so you're really saying that the realism of this film goes beyond simply the graphic nature of the violence that's depicted. There is a realistic treatment of the entire event as history, as real, and as the claim that underpins the event, the exclusive claims of Christ to be Savior of all sinners, that the... Do you think the American public is consciously understanding the attraction of this objective truth claim here?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that would vary from viewer to viewer. I think there are an awful lot of people who are understanding that, or who, if they go in indifferent to that or confused about it, come away deeply affected. I mean, it seems to me you can't watch the film and not take seriously, not entertain, at least for the time of the film and for some time after, because this is a film that stays with you for hours, days, weeks after you've seen it. I don't think you can walk away from it and not entertain seriously the possibility, the claim that Christ makes about himself. I think the film does a remarkable job at that level of realism. It seems to me that in many ways the film is shot through with symbolism, so it's not... It's not a realistic film in the sense that it attempts to divest itself of all symbolic or allegorical interpretation, but it's a realist film in the sense that it wants to take that claim seriously and to present that before the viewer.
Well, of course, objective truth is not common fare on the silver screen or in popular culture.
Right.
Tell us a bit about the popular nihilism, the denial of truth and of the ability to know truth that we find in our culture.
Well, I think that's connected with something that this film is running counter to, which is the notion that there is no such thing as truth, that whatever truth we might hold, and this is the quickest way to undermine truth, is something that we've constructed or that we've made up. So that that goes from a certain popular view that all religions are just man-made myths, to a kind of popular view that the most important thing is just that we have opinions, not whether these opinions be true or false. That there's, at some level, a sort of liberal political view of the freedom of the individual mixes with a kind of market capitalism, and we end up with a sort of view that that all we have are preferences. And we can manipulate those preferences and make people think one way or the other, but we really can't at all get at the truth. And that leads directly to a kind of nihilism where there is no possibility of distinguishing better and worse ways of life, no possibility of distinguishing good from evil, no possibility of distinguishing noble from base or love from manipulation, truth from falsity. So, and I think we can see strains of this nihilism in film and television over the past 30 years. Certainly this film, there are other films too. I don't want to say this is the only film doing this, but this film runs directly counter to those tendencies. It's also a film that in the graphic violence that you mentioned moments ago, I think, and I have questions at a certain point whether Gibson shouldn't have cut it off a little bit, but he does a marvelous job with the flashbacks and so forth. I think what he's trying to do there, I mean, we are a culture that is awash in violence. It's there on our nightly news. It is there in children's books, the Harry Potter books, which I like the Harry Potter books, but there are heavy doses of violence in there. It's there on our primetime television, whether it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer or CSI. It's certainly there in very popular mainstream horror films. The entire Tarantino genre will get Kill Bill Part 2 in another month.
Oh, yeah.
And we are awash in very explicit graphic violence. I think what Gibson was up to in the depiction of violence in this film, he was in his own films in the past, not What Women Want, but other films have been quite violent. I think what he was doing in this film with the violence is saying, I'm going to take all that violence on in the culture and take it up into this film, just as Christ takes up within himself and upon himself all the evil and the violence of the world, and I'm going to show how this culture awash in a kind of nihilistic violence can be transformed and redeemed by the sacrificial act of Christ. So I think there was an explicit strategy that he had in mind. He knows the audience, he knows his culture, and he was giving us a depiction of Christ that is in certain levels an artistic depiction that will last for many, many ages. But it's also a depiction that is geared to this time, this culture, and this place.
So he knows his audience.
That's right.
There's a very little blurring, if any at all, of good and evil in Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ. There was a catchphrase in one of the Seinfeld episodes that dealt with, I think, homosexuality at one point. Not that there's anything wrong with that. That
right.
was the catchphrase,
That's
which
right.
is kind of the popular credo for, you know, we are just a culture of opinion and not of right and wrong. You really can't walk away from Gibson's film and watch what's going on there in The Passion of the Christ and say, well, not that there's anything wrong with that.
That's right. That's right. You can't. You also can't run home if you like the film and start calling people and saying, "Gee, you got to go see this." I mean, at some level, you can tell them you must see it, but you don't run home as you would from an ordinary film, having eaten popcorns and whatever kind of candy you like, and tell people, "Gee, you got to go see this. I had a great time at this film." It's a film that induces a very somber, sort of reflective mood in people. I mean, certainly the people when I saw an early viewing of this. People were deeply moved, and you could hear people sniffling, some people crying. And then at the end, you know, people walk out as if you've come from a funeral of a dear friend. I think that's the mood and the dominant emotion when you walk out of that. And I think in that respect, the film succeeds at it. Gibson not only knows his audience, but he succeeds at communicating with them.
We're talking about The Passion of the Christ, the film by Mel Gibson, of course. Dr. Thomas Hibbs is our guest, Dean of the Honors College at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Shows About Nothing. Now, in the next 15 minutes, at the end of this conversation, I want to hear from you. If Mel Gibson asked you what film should he do next, well, how would you respond? And that's an interesting question for you, Dr. Hibbs, as well. I mean, I mentioned the last film he made, What Women Want, and watching that either last night or several nights ago, thinking, wow, here's the guy who's mugging for the camera with the beautiful blue eyes, playing opposite a gorgeous blonde.
Right.
And his next film is The Passion of the Christ. I'm trying to get my head around that.
Right.
But if Gibson were to ask you, Dr. Hibbs, well, okay, here I've done it, my opus magnum, what should I do next? How would you respond?
Well, I think not Lethal Weapon 5. that would be my first thought. You know, he has said, I mean, in interviews in the last 4 or 5 days, I've only caught snippets of this, but I gather that he is considering a number of Old Testament stories that he might like to consider doing. And I think that would make a certain kind of sense. It is, I think, you know, What Women Want is a sort of detour. If you look at his other films, and I would see, you know, the Lethal Weapons films and so forth. Actually, when I watched the interview with Diane Sawyer, I thought, this guy is Riggs. He is the character from Lethal Weapon. I mean, he's edgy. He's telling these stories about, you know, nearly committing suicide or at least contemplating it, being sort of troubled constantly by questions of justice and what's the best way of life. That character in the Lethal Weapon film, especially the first two entries in that, very much like that. I mean, a character who considers putting his gun up to his mouth and blowing his head off because of the loss of his wife and his sense that life is pointless and justice is elusive. But I think the trajectory here goes from a film like that through a film like Braveheart and We Were Soldiers, you know, where you see someone who is actively willing to, once he's pulled in, he doesn't go out looking for it, but once he's pulled into a situation of battle, is willing to sacrifice for a greater good than himself. So I think there is a kind of trajectory that points toward The Passion of the Christ, if you set What Women Want aside as a sort of light comic film that he did along the way. I think there are certain preoccupations in Gibson's film that certainly no one could have anticipated The Passion of the Christ. But looking back now, you can see that some of the issues he was preoccupied with in other films, especially Braveheart, make it not entirely unlikely for this film to come into being.
What position does the objective truth so starkly portrayed in Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, what position does it put the Christian church, especially in America, that has, to a large degree, carefully avoided objective truth from the pulpit and its teaching for a number of decades now?
Well, I think the greatest resistance to Gibson's film is coming largely from that group. I think certainly there are questions raised about anti-Semitism and so forth, but I think the largest sustained resistance has been coming from folks in academia who are in religion departments and who assumed that we had taken care of that older view of Christianity, that it had been safely defanged, that it had been rendered innocuous. And Gibson comes along and presents this truth claim as the central theme of a very powerful, very artistically crafted film. And I think it puts that mainstream religious practice and theory, the practice of it in parishes and churches across America, and the theory of it in many Christian universities and secular universities, it makes it very uneasy and much harder to kind of dismiss. And I think that's why so many folks were out there criticizing this film before they'd even seen it, something they would have with a film like The Last Temptation of Christ decried immediately, the very idea that anyone would critique a film without having seen it. And yet there were so many academics, so many church leaders out criticizing this film before they'd even seen the first frame of it.
Is this the beginning of a trend? I read in the New York Times late last week, that filmmakers in Hollywood observing only the box office of the first 3 weeks of Gibson's film are starting to think about religious topics. What kind of confidence do you have in their ability to deliver the same kind of objective truth?
None. We already seen this with this film Judas that came on to primetime television a couple weeks back and was simply, you know, brought out from dust on the shelves because people wanted to try and ride this, and it didn't do well at all. I don't know exactly what kind of ratings it got, but it didn't do well in its time slot. So I don't have much confidence that Hollywood will be able to do much more than to try and mimic it with very superficial sorts of projects that they'll try to rush through, and these things will bomb. It does seem to me that there's a possibility that there are people out there who are either in Hollywood or who are in some way on the fringes of Hollywood who may themselves have had some sort of conversion experience like Gibson has had, only they haven't talked about it. They haven't pursued projects because of fears that it would go nowhere. And what Gibson has done with the success of his film might open up a path for other people who have had distinctive religious experiences of some depth and who are already talented as filmmakers to proceed along the lines of the path that Gibson has paved for them. But my guess is that there are very few of those people, but that there might be some out there. I mean, who knew 10 years ago that Gibson was this sort of person harboring these sorts of plans and thoughts? I mean, this didn't come to the forefront until he started actually making the film. So it might open the door for some other people, but it's not going to open the door for generic Hollywood folks who don't understand religion at all to come in and do anything other than junk that will bomb.
Is not a generic Hollywood type. Ron Howard, who's made some rather stunning films of late, is reported to be working on a film version of The Da Vinci Code. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it is striking that you've got this film that's number one at the box office, and then you've got this book that was doing that has been doing extremely well in its sales. I don't know what to say about that. It seems to me the book is a fiction book that wants to try to masquerade as a kind of history by talking about its documentation and its sources and so forth. And that book fits more with a view of religion as something that's hooked up with myths and things that we can manipulate to our liking. So it strikes me that Da Vinci Code is is much more swimming with the general culture than is Gibson's film, which I would describe as being more countercultural.
And again, as to the question of a trend, given the fact that Hollywood does depend upon the box office mm-hmm. to survive, is Gibson's film, does it stand as a singular effort in objective truth? Or can we expect any other efforts?
Well, look, I've seen some good signs over the past few years in Hollywood. I mean, just look at not this past year, but the year before. Actually, this past year was pretty good, too. But the year before, you had films like Lord of the Rings, like Spider-Man, Big Fat Greek Wedding, one of the Star Wars prequels. There was a sense in the things that did well in the box office that Americans were hungry for something more than empty, nihilistic celebrations of violence or simply celebrations of adolescent passion. And more serious films, I mean, I think that The Passion, along with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, just, you know, remarkably successful trilogy, very well done films that touch upon classical Christian themes, the great grand mythic themes about good and evil. I think there's some good signs out there that film goers, viewers at least, are hungry for something much more than what Hollywood has been delivering over the past 15 or 20 years. And I think there are going to be some people at the fringes who will now get an opportunity that they would not have had before.
Dr. Thomas Hibbs, thank you very much for your time and for being our guest again on Issues, Etc.
Great to be with you once again.
Dr. Thomas Hibbs is Dean of the Honors College at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and he's author of the book Shows About Nothing. You can find out more about that book by going to the website for Spence Publishing. It's spencepublishing.com, spencepublishing.com. There's a www in front of that. Or you can call Spence Publishing toll-free at 1-888-SPEN-PUB. 1-888-SPENPUB. Now, when we come back from this break, your phone calls on what should be the follow-up movie to The Passion of the Christ. I imagine that in addition to press inquiries, Mel Gibson's office is pretty busy hearing and fielding pitches on future films. He's proven he can make a blockbuster. At the very least, he can make a successful film. I want to know, what do you think that film ought to be? What do you think it will be? The best callers during this open lines that follows our break will receive Brian Gadawa's book, Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment, absolutely free. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Also, we'll be hearing from the attorney for the two Unitarian Universalist ministers who today in New York were arraigned on charges of, well, they're misdemeanor charges of carrying out civil ceremonies without due authorization, without the proper licensing. They married 13 gay couples. They're being charged by civil authorities with doing this. And it raises a big question about civil authorities stepping into the business of the church. We'll be hearing from that and hopefully hearing a conservative reaction to the Methodist goings-on up in Washington State. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Peeps, chocolate bunnies, colored eggs, all popular Easter gifts for young children. This Easter, why not give them something that will last? Something spiritual. Like our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March, Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net. This new children's book explains how the life of Simon Peter is really a story about God's grace. You can browse before you buy on our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Follow Me costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Follow Me contains simple language and colorful illustrations for a young child, grandchild, or godchild. It's written by Issues, Etc. regular guest, Pastor Eric Rotman. Follow Me, Peter Lays Down His Net, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March. 1-800-325-3040.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on a country where radio can speed news about Christ. It's in the East African country of Sudan. Educational Media Corporation, through its Global Endeavor Ministry, has recently placed 3 radio stations on air inside Sudan. The radio signals blanket the entire country with Christian programming. This is vital since hundreds of thousands of Christians have died in Sudan from persecution during the past decade. Global Endeavor has established Radios for Sudan. It's a project to put 10,000 solar and hand crank radio sets into families and villages. Pray that the support and distribution of these radio sets will fill people in Sudan with Christ's hope. Get more news about Radios for Sudan by calling Global Endeavor at 1-877-255-8667. That's 1-877-255-8667.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Several weeks ago, I wrote that self-righteousness, not ethnicity, killed Jesus. Some of you questioned me. Wasn't Christ really killed by all us sinners? I once heard of a woman who said it was nice Jesus died, but he really didn't have to do that for her. She didn't think she killed Jesus. Who did? Is my name Pontius Pilate or Caiaphas? Am I a Roman soldier who whipped Jesus or drove the nails into his hands and feet? No, I am not. So in that sense, I didn't crucify Jesus. Did my sins force Jesus to die? No. Nothing about us forces God to do anything, including our sins. Jesus says in John 10:17, "No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord." Jesus could have let us sinners get the just deserts of our sin, a hellish prospect. So, who caused the crucifixion? Only the free and unconstrained love of God, who is willing to lay down his life for us lost sinners. Romans 5 says, "One will scarcely die for a righteous person, but God shows his love for us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." When you take time to think it through, it's
God
amazing.
Has saved me.
Grace.
How he has made me his own, and how he now works through me to do fruit of the Holy Spirit. There are things that need to happen in you. For instance, repentance, faith, good works. But guess what? You don't do any of them by your own power, by your own choice. They're done spontaneously by the work of the Holy Spirit.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. The next 90 minutes of Issues, Etc. is open lines for your questions and your comments. Now, it's anything you want to talk about. Of course, it is Monday. I do have a question that I would like your answer to. Mel Gibson made this great movie. He's made a lot of money with it. He's going to make a lot more money with it when DVD and video comes out, of course, and the merchandising. It's a blockbuster. There's no two ways about it. Okay, it's up there with the top films in the last 25 years. What's his next movie? What's the next movie he makes? Now, I mentioned before that sometime during this weekend, I happened to catch on cable What Women Want. My wife and I had rented that on video when it had come out on video. And lighthearted little kind of nonsense comedy. Helen Hunt, I think it is, and Mel Gibson together playing opposite one another. The Tracy Hepburn kind of thing going on. I think that's what they were aiming for. But I watched this, and I could not help watching Mel Gibson mug for the camera and play this part. Just the dissonance in my mind between that and the images that were stuck with me from his latest film venture, The Passion of the Christ. And it does make one wonder, what movie is he going to make next? I'd like your answer to that question. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What about a sequel to the film? I mean, this is the next logical step in Hollywood. When you have something that is successful, you make a sequel. In fact, many films are pitched with the idea of a built-in sequel already. I mean, think about it. Many of them are filmed under this premise. The Matrix films. They had one big movie. It could have stood all by itself. But it was ready-made also for a sequel. What did they do? They went and they filmed two. I mean, you might as well squeeze the turnip while blood's coming out, right? Now, most people who saw the first one thought, unbelievable, great film, groundbreaking. Second one, okay, it better get better in the third one. And the third one was largely panned by the critics. Another ready-made sequel mania, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You can't just make one film there. You've got to tell the whole story. You can't tell it all in one movie and do any justice to the story. You make three films. You go to Australia or New Zealand or wherever they were. You film everything all at once. You come back and you've got three movies. Prequel, main attraction, sequel. There it is. The Star Wars films. What about The Passion of the Christ? I mean, can you do a sequel? Jim Caviezel has already said he's never doing it again. So you'd have to find someone else to play Jesus. Caviezel says he just won't do it again. It was too difficult. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The best callers during this hour of open lines will receive Brian Godawa's book, Hollywood Worldviews. Let's go first with Stan, who's calling from his car. Stan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you. Zeffirelli, I guess it was, made The Life of Christ for TV, and that was fairly true to form. With his, what would they call it, artistic talent, I'd like to see him make a sequel to that, The Life of Christ After the Resurrection. I would think that would really go well also. Maybe not. I don't know.
All right, Stan, thank you very much. Now, he's got 40 days of material, although I wonder if you could even get 2 hours. Out of what Scripture gives us. You're going to stick with Scripture. Apart from what Scripture gives us of the post-resurrection appearances of Christ, you've got, let me see if I can just run through these in my mind. You've got at the tomb with Mary. You've got upper room, and these are the ones we're told about explicitly. Upper room, 11 disciples. Road to Emmaus. Supposedly then, according to Luke's account, another upper room appearance after the road to Emmaus when the Emmaus guys get back. You've got a week later. I'm sorry, the first one was with the 10 disciples. You got a week later with the 11, including Thomas. You've got an appearance by the Sea of Galilee where he roasts fish and reinstates Peter. You've got the appearance at the Ascension. Now, you do have some others alluded to, like an appearance to over 500 people at one time, an appearance to Peter that we're never told the details of, an appearance to James that we're never told the details to. And you could probably fill in the gaps with speculation. But you do, okay, think of that in terms of a story. Jesus kind of popping in and popping out, which is what happens, at least according to the gospel accounts there. What about the Acts of the Apostles? How would you shoot the Ascension? That's a good question. Could you draw a movie-going audience to a film like that? I mean, it's Stan's suggestion. To a film like that that doesn't have the kind of, well, the obvious draw of watch a man get crucified. Because a lot of people who are going to this film, The Passion of the Christ, are not necessarily going because it's the greatest film in the world or because they are interested in what the movie's about. They're going because they get to watch a man be crucified. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Carol's next, calling from her car. Carol, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi.
Hi, Carol.
I think the next movie he ought to make, I think would be very interesting, is Life of St. Paul.
That's a great suggestion. Thank you, Carol. That was the one I was thinking of. Life of St. Paul. Now, you could do a trilogy on the life of St. Paul easily. There would be some difficulties, of course, but just as a story goes, it's a compelling story. We had Fritz Bowie on last week. He did his review of The Passion of the Christ as a film, laying aside the theological considerations, but as a film. We got some reaction from our audience then. To that as well. And he said the part of the problem is doing a film with Jesus as the main character is Jesus is perfect and sinless. If you will accurately depict him, you do not see him going through the same quote-unquote redemptive process that other characters in other stories go through. There is not much character arc. he doesn't have some fatal flaw at the beginning of the story that is then over time corrected or answered for in the course of the story. This is what we've become accustomed to in good storytelling. The antagonist is the main character, the focus of the story, goes through a process. Well, Jesus doesn't go through a process as a character. So if you're going to make a Jesus film, you do have to deal with the part of the problem of being, you've got a sinless and perfect main character, which doesn't necessarily make for an interesting story. It is the story that saves us. It's not necessarily an interesting story the way we judge interesting stories today. Paul, on the other hand, now there's a character that you can empathize with. I mean, you talk about character arc. Persecutor of the church, murderer of Christians, boom. One afternoon on the road to Damascus, the next day everything's changed, and his life goes downhill from there, radically downhill. I mean, he had it great before he met Jesus. After Jesus meets him on the road and turns him around, literally turns him around, his life just goes from bad to worse. I will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. And the dialogue practically writes itself. Thanks for the suggestion, Carol. Chet's on the line calling from his car. Chet, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, sir, Pastor Wilkins. In my thinking, I guess I'm thinking along the same lines as Carol, but what better sequel than the Acts of the Apostle? I mean, you could start right off with appearances of Jesus after the resurrection. You could do Pentecost, the Ethiopian eunuch's conversion, when Stephen was martyred, and then, you know, the whole issue with the council at Jerusalem and Paul. I mean, the main thing about that, you'd be able to explain what the crucifixion of Christ was all about by doing the Acts of the Apostle, spread of Christianity. You know, maybe that may be too broad, which would limit you in the future for other sequels, but that's my thinking.
All right, Chet, thank you very much. Maybe you could just call the film Peter and Paul. I mean, that would be a great idea. Peter and Paul. Now, Peter would be the first main character, and Paul would be the second main character. If you follow the Acts of the Apostles, that's basically the outline. You got the Peter part, where Peter kind of is the center of Luke's story. And then you got the Paul part. There's very little overlap there. Of course, the baby boomers would probably all be confused, thinking they should stick Mary in there and we could hear some folk music. By the way, I watched A Mighty Wind. This is just a complete aside, okay? But just let me say this. I watched A Mighty Wind last night. Craig, have you seen A Mighty Wind?
I haven't seen it.
Funny movie. Did you like Spinal Tap?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, my goodness. You just get up and leave right now. You haven't seen Spinal Tap? Go watch Spinal Tap on DVD, then go to your cable set and watch A Mighty Wind. That's a complete aside. It's a complete distraction. I'm sorry, folks. Great movie. Peter and Paul, there you go. Pentecost, you could have some special effects in there. You could get the Ascension in there as well. Yeah, good suggestion. What about the rest of you? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jeff is calling from his car. Jeff, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. I was going to make almost the same suggestion as Chet did, except follow along the Apostle John, since he led, you know, a natural life is what he died. You know, he died a natural death. You know, surely he's seen what went on during the early church, and maybe tie in a little bit of revelation with it too.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't considered that. Although and thank you for the call there. How would you do revelation though? I mean, except just hint at it. Because that in and of itself, you know, there are people who would argue, they are making a revelation film. It's called the Left Behind series of films. I mean, by comparison to Gibson's Passion, that's the one good thing that Gibson's Passion has done. It has basically cast and shown us what a real film looks like, as opposed to your typical kind of low production value, badly lit, badly acted Christian genre film. Hopefully we won't have to put up with any more of those after Gibson's film. Maybe Christians will realize that it doesn't have to be badly acted and badly lit. Don't you type up that stuff. There are things I can't of which I cannot speak here. Let's talk with Terry, who's calling from St. Louis. Terry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I'd really like to see the life of Jesus start with the angel visiting Mary and going all the way through the miracles, all the way up into where we ended with Palm Sunday, where we started Palm Sunday at this movie.
So maybe a prequel to The Passion of the Christ?
Sure, you could call it something like that. Because I'm hearing a lot of people say there are people out there who don't know what happened before this. They don't know the story that he starts with the death without ever knowing about the life of Jesus. So I'd like to see the life of Jesus.
Okay, that's a good suggestion, Terry. Thank you. We should be warned here that the important thing for Christians and all men to know, and that's why Gibson was a genius to make The Passion of the Christ, is his passion, his death and his resurrection. One can be ignorant of Jesus' teachings, of the rest of his life. And if one knows only that he went as a sinless sacrifice to the cross for the sins of all the world, then that message is sufficient to save. But, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. If I were a director, how would you do the angel appearing to the shepherds outside Bethlehem? That would be an amazing open to a film. Think about that. I mean, just in terms of its visual impact. The angel appearing. I mean, I'm thinking about, what do? You have this scene over a tranquil moonlit hillside. You've got the sheep kind of all bunched up because it's a little bit cold. You got the dogs. The dogs are all sitting around the sheep, pretty much docile. You know, their ears aren't perked up. You got the shepherds just lolling off in the corner there. And then when the angel appears, you've got the sheep are scattering all over the place. You've got the dogs barking. The shepherds falling all over themselves, all until the angel says, "Fear not." Then the dogs sit down, the sheep all get calm, and we hear what the shepherds heard. "I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all men." It would be a great opening for a film. Now, the problem is, it would almost make the birth of the baby seem anticlimactic, wouldn't it? To be careful how you tell that story, I think. Larry's calling from his car. Larry, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Good afternoon. I think it's a great idea, having the Book of Acts. I've had one experience with that kind of already, but not in a movie. I was a camp counselor in my 30s, and I had about a dozen kids that I was supposed to have a Bible study with up, you know, on a hill at the camp in Iowa, and it was only supposed to last 45 minutes. We were just going through the Book of Acts. It ended up lasting almost 2 hours, and the camp director even came up the hill to find out, you know, where all these kids had gone. They didn't want to put it down. We ended up doing the whole book. I think it's a great idea.
Larry, thank you very much. And there's no doubt, if there's a storyteller among the evangelists, I mean, they're all unbelievably crafted accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all for their own reasons. But if there is a storyteller in the sense of a modern storyteller, the kind of story that we find compelling, it's Luke. Be it Luke's gospel or his Acts of the Apostles. Christina's on the line. She's calling from her car. Christina, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Christina.
I think they should make a movie of Moses and the Exodus.
Well, that one has been done.
Yeah.
I mean, Cecil B. DeMille was... You were always going to look for the comparisons there.
Yeah.
So you would mind the Old Testament for its stories in the next film if Gibson were going to make another one?
Yeah.
All right, Christina, thank you very much. It would be hard to do an Exodus film without the obvious comparisons to the Ten Commandments. What if you went elsewhere in the Old Testament? Where would you go? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. So Gibson has one big directing and producing, well, he's done others, of course, blockbusters, but this one was all his. He's got it under his belt. He obviously can make a film and make money with it. and get people to come out and see it. Whatever he makes next, people will see. That's guaranteed. What should it be? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jason's up next, calling from St. Louis. Jason, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. First of all, to respond to your previous suggestion, if you're going to suggest Spinal Tap, I'd also think about Waiting for Guffman. But as to your actual question, there's a couple different thoughts that I had had. First of all, I read in the Post last week that Gibson was thinking about doing the story of the Maccabean Revolt, which I think would be interesting in light of the criticism that The Passion of the Christ has gotten. As far as what movie I would think would be most interesting, there's two. The first is a Lutheran. I would be interested to see what he would do if he just focused on the character of Peter, and in light of his Roman Catholic background, to see what direction he might take with that.
That would be interesting.
The other one that I had thought about, just because you asked about what other Old Testament characters, that I can't think of a really good movie that's ever been done on David. And the many stories that you could do throughout his life would be very telling. I don't know if you talk about the regular character arc. I think I don't know how well that would work with David's life. But it would be interesting to see what a skillful director would do with that.
Jason, thank you very much. Stay on hold if you would, and my producer will connect up with you. I'd like to send you a copy of Brian Gadawa's book, Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Now, yes, I'd heard this too. A caller had called in, I think in the course of our conversation with Fritz Bowie last week, to inform us that at least he had read that Gibson's next idea might be to do something on the Maccabean Revolt. Now, this is intertestamental stuff. This is from the Apocrypha, from the books that fall between the Testaments. And they are regarded as, in their broad outline, to be historically accurate. In their detail, perhaps, not all of them, of course, but in their detail, to perhaps not to be as historically accurate as we would, of course, consider Scripture to be historically accurate. But if he wanted to counter charges of anti-Semitism, Judas Maccabeus would be a character to do a film about. And I imagine as a devout Roman Catholic, he probably wouldn't have a big problem with that, since that is considered, at the very least, quasi-canonical. He could go there. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I wonder what he will make, though. I can understand someone saying, if he's pitching the idea to anyone but himself, you say, Jesus, last 12 hours of Jesus' life. People say, yeah, that's the story we can make. If you walk into the producer's office, you say, Judas Maccabeus, they'll probably say, Gesundheit. Andy's calling from Kirkwood. Andy, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Well, first the bad news. NBC is already planning a mini-series on Revelation. I can hardly wait to see how that turns out. Secondly, I think one of the strong points of the Gibson film is that he left out the halos and the overdone piety that we see in a great many of the older Christian films from the 50s and early 60s. I think that the nativity done in kind of a hard scrabble manner with the tension provided by people's response to an unmarried mother, the idea that Joseph has been cuckolded, the idea of not being able to find a place for the birth and of Herod's threat and so forth, I think that could really be done dramatically and well and break away from the traditional warm fuzzies that we get at Christmas time and maybe show what it was really like, just as he did with the Passion. The other thought that I had was a life of Jesus focusing on his relationship with the Pharisees, casting them not as villains but as sincere religious people, and then doing the contrast between law and gospel real strong. I think that might be a good film.
Andy, thank you so much. Good suggestions there. The kind of realistic treatment, I think there's so much already in the nativity accounts by way of story. There's so much already there that you could do a completely realistic. Look at this. You've got, as Andy pointed out, you've got unwed mother, Joseph. angelic apparitions. The king, Herod, you got visitors from afar. The king, Herod, out to kill the child, a flight into Egypt. You have, of course, the miraculous birth as well. Now, how do you bring that to a close, though? Because there's so much there already for a film, if Gibson's going to make such a film. How do you bring that to a close? Gary's calling from Ontario, Canada. He's listening on the internet. Gary, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Todd.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that Mel Gibson should make a film about creation and the fall into sin. And with that, you could use the pre-incarnate Christ as the very source of creation.
So, let's see, first three chapters of Genesis, basically?
Yeah. And, I mean, you could go as far as the flood, you know, but...
I'm trying to think. Same question.
I'm just thinking artistically, you can go, you know, with the creation, and then, you know, the dramatic wonder of creation, and contrast that with this world once it's fallen into sin. With that, you can include and give an explanation to the serpent being stepped on by Christ in the garden.
That's true. Thank you very much, Gary. I've got some thoughts on that because. If you end that film in the wrong place, you have a very, not only depressing message, you got a message that doesn't tell the rest of the story. You could really end it in the wrong place. There is a place where you could end it that probably would get the gospel message across, which, if you want to be consistent with the Gibson's earlier film there, that would be something you'd have to deliver. Nam is calling from St. Louis. Nam, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi. I was thinking, how about the life of Job? If that's not an overcomer, I don't know who is.
All right. Thank you very much. Now I'm trying to think. Although if you go and look, it would be a great film to make first two, three chapters. And I'm thinking about just watching it on film. Then you have, how do you depict 30 plus chapters of Job sitting in the ash heap being tormented by his so-called friends? And then it's got a happy ending, of course. It could be done. See, I'm no filmmaker, so I look at that and I think, well, beginning, middle, and end. Great beginning, rather boring middle, good end. We'll continue to take your phone calls on what should be the follow-up to Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ after this break. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Then we'll get Dr. Thomas Oden's reaction to the Methodist lesbian pastor's acquittal that took place this weekend. That's coming up next on Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.